What's up, everyone? This is Steve and Ronald for episode 003 of Movie Schmovie. We are at the pivotal tripod stage of this podcast where that third leg comes down and hopefully we start to develop an actual format and, and get a little bit of regularity to this podcast.
I think it's coming into its own. As I listen to it, I think it's developing some character.
It's shaping a little bit.
It's getting some legs.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about a lot today. We're going to be pretty... I'm actually personally really excited about this podcast. This is a big step for us in terms of actually being ahead of the curve with the movie. We're fortunate enough to see the film that we're reviewing before it came out in theaters. So we are actually right on time with recording and actually releasing this podcast as the film is going to open this weekend, June 10th. And the movie that I'm speaking about is Super 8.
Super 8.
J.J. Abrams. We posted on our blog a little bit ago. I threw the poster up there. I've been really excited about this movie for quite some time.
Yes.
But yeah, we were fortunate enough to see it just last night, and we're really excited to be talking about it and getting this out, you know, right on time with the film's release in theaters.
So before we start, a couple things. We now have a URL, like an official URL. So it's movieschmovie.net. Now you can also reach us at the Tumblr web address, which will just be redirected to the movieschmovie.net web address. So we have a URL now.
So we're official. We're legit.
We're legit.
We can actually make up flyers and not have some long address on there. We have a really sleek, sexy movieschmovie.net address now.
Definitely.
Thanks to GoDaddy.
Thanks to GoDaddy.
GoDaddy people.
They're incredible. You can reach us at movieschmovie@gmail.com. Also, Tumblr at movieschmovie. So if you want to hit us up, twitter.com/movieschmovie. So that's the way we can contact us. Now, we've been actually getting some responses, some actual email, some feedback, which is incredible.
Yeah, much appreciated.
Some iTunes ratings and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's really big for us. So if you are listening now for the first time or for the second or third time, that kind of feedback is, you know, always appreciated and also solicited. So please send it our way. As we mentioned last time, we're going to get basically start this new feature at the beginning of our podcast called the Mighty Minute Review. We had a couple people send us some emails over the past week. And basically what it is that we're going to take viewers and listeners' suggestions for movies that they would like to know what we think about them and talk about them in a minute or less. So this week, actually, we got some emails. And actually, we got an email from our buddy Bert. That we both used to work with.
Yeah, great guy.
Had a lot of movies listed that we really, you know, had seen, had some thoughts on, but one really stood out, mainly in terms of its relevance for this week's podcast, and that would be the 80s classic Back to the Future.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough roads to get up to 88.
Roads? Well, we're going, we don't need roads.
Yes.
The reason that we chose it this week is because it basically correlates directly with Super 8, as in Steven Spielberg is executive produced both films, you know, nearly, you know, 20 or 30 years apart of the two.
Yeah.
It's pretty big thing. And actually, Back to the Future is personally one of my probably all-time favorite movies. What do you think about the film, Ronald?
It's tremendous. It's so ahead of its time in terms of just the sci-fi aspect of it and time travel. It was handled really, really well in a way that could be understood by the sci-fi addict to the casual kind of sci-fi sort of guy that, you know, just coming in, seeing that it's a cool car, seeing that you can, you know, time travel. It's a great movie. I think that it's one of the best movies ever created, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. I think I've seen that movie way too many times that you almost lose count. I've seen the film in its re-release in theaters a few years ago. The DVD box sets, the trilogy is great. The sequels aren't on par with the original. So, you know, if you had not seen Back to the Future, like Ronald said, comedy, romance, you know, action, sci-fi, just a super well-rounded film. I mean, I think it kind of really was one of the first films that I saw that was just like pure entertainment for me.
Yeah, definitely.
And even Soccer looking fish. Back on it now, you know, like I say, that movie was made in 85, so you know, nearly 30 years ago, the film holds up. You know, you can watch it today for the first time or for the fifth time and still experience it in the same way. So Back to the Future, two thumbs up, way, way up for me. Absolutely. And thanks for the suggestion, Bert. Keep them coming. Now we're going to move on and actually get to talking about Super 8. I remember seeing the teaser trailer last year for Super 8 in theaters, where it just basically had the footage of the train crashing, just a lot of audio.
Yeah.
And you saw the pounding on the outside of the cart. And, you know, right from the get-go, I was super excited for it. I mean, as soon as I saw the names up on the screen that were associated with it, J.J. Abrams, Steven Spielberg, and through some research, I had seen some of the other, the cast that was set up at that point, but... you know, the suspense, the mystery that surrounded it for the past, you know, over a year now, has definitely had me on edge to see it. And, from what I knew about the film, you know, I just was excited because of what I knew it was going to be.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
The kind of movie that it is.
Definitely. J.J. Abrams is an amazing storyteller. He's responsible for the show Alias, which was tremendous. Lost, which is...
We don't even need to address that. Yeah. Like people that don't know about Lost probably shouldn't be listening to this podcast.
Yeah, you shouldn't be.
You should be watching that.
So that's just to give you an idea of what kind of storyteller he is. The scale of his stories are always they always have heart. They always have really cool elements that kind of weave personal relationships with the craziness that's going on and kind of craziness bringing people together. And that's a common theme in a lot of his movies.
I think what one of J.J. Abrams' his touch is that he does really great job at, you know, weaving a story into a really grandiose idea. You know, with Lost or with Alias or, you know, even other things he's been a part of, you know, like even rebooting franchises with fresh new takes with, you know, Mission Impossible 3. You know, with the new Star Trek remake, you know, which is incredible in my opinion.
Definitely was.
You know, he's got a really nice touch at, you know, a lot of people knew we could take, you know, from what he did with those two franchises to the, you know, to the big screen. And there was some, you know, skepticism about how his original story idea, you know, having written and directed Super 8, you know, how that would translate instead of just being, you know, a franchise or something that already existed. I think that one of my big things going in to see Super 8, like I mentioned earlier, is that, you know, in the early 80s, I was born in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I saw a lot of movies as a kid. You know, I think one of my all-time favorite films is E.T. And I can remember seeing that movie as a kid. I can remember relating to it and just, like, it just completely engrossing me. And it's really one of the reasons why I ever got into movies and I've been in the movies as much as I have. And, you know, if you've read about this film at all, about Super 8, you definitely have heard comparisons to E.T.
Yeah.
And it's valid, and it's like the ultimate compliment to him because I think that, you know, Steven Spielberg really set the stage with that film. It's a movie that's like this big summer blockbuster tentpole release for Paramount Pictures, but it's like this huge monster film, but it's like, it's more so this story about these kids and their relationships with one another and their relationships with the adults in their lives and like coming to terms with certain things that have happened in their lives, and there just happens to be this, like, alien monster on the loose, you know? And I think that really kind of keeps the film in perspective. As crazy as everything else is in the world, like, this monster terrorizing this town or whatever it's doing to this town, to some of these kids, these little things that are going on in their lives, that means so much more.
Yeah, you know? Definitely. So, the story takes place in the summer of 1979. So, there's a bunch of stuff going on. So, let me introduce some of the characters. So, there's a group of friends, there's a character, let me see if I find his name. So his name is Joel Courtney. No, Joel Courtney's not the main lead. Is it the...
Yeah, that's Joel Courtney. That's Joe.
Okay.
He's our
So one thing lead. That J.J. Abrams did, I forgot to mention this prior to introducing these characters, is he brought a bunch of fresh faces to the screen. One of the kind of... It's a good thing because it kind of... Your palate... You don't know what's going to happen with these characters.
There's no expectations.
There's no expectations. There's no prior experience attached to it. And you don't have any typecast with these people. So the lead, his name is...
Joel Lamb.
Joel Courtney is actually 15 years old. First time ever being on a screen. First movie. And
good job, Joel.
Yes, amazing. Riley Griffiths is the character that wants to direct a movie. It's a zombie film, and the character Carrie, no, not Carrie, the character
Alice?
Joe. I'm sorry. Joe Lamb is actually the makeup artist. He's the main character.
Right, right, right.
He has just lost his mom very recently to mysterious circumstances. You don't know exactly what happened. You know there's an accident, but the circumstances surrounding it aren't necessarily defined at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
So his he also has a friend, Carrie, that does fireworks, really known as a bad guy in the neighborhood. Martin, who plays the detective character in the zombie movie, he's older, a little older out of them. He's kind of like the pushover character. The director, Charles, is very, very kind of aggressive. He knows what he wants, and he's pretty much one of the bossiest characters. And there's Preston, who plays the president in the movie. And a couple other characters.
Yeah.
So you start off with this group of characters, and it starts off right at this funeral. So you're seeing the relationships between the friends, and they're talking about the circumstances surrounding the death of the main character's mom.
Joe's mom.
So it kind of takes. It kind of starts right there and escalates. So
right. Flash forward 4 months. And you see that, like, you know, Joe has somewhat gotten back to a normal life. He's back in school.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like school's out for the summer. You know, the buddies are talking about, oh, yeah, you're going to still help me with the movie. We're shooting this new scene. Charles, who is the friend that is the director character, the first thing I thought of is there's probably an obvious correlation between him and actually, like, J.J. Abrams, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I definitely feel like J.J. Abrams is, with this being an original story, probably... I don't know the dude, but I would assume that, you know, that's probably the character modeled mostly on him. I mean, this guy, this kid in middle school, you know, he's got like this vision for this zombie movie. And it's really touching, you know, the first thing that you hear him talking about is how he like wrote this new scene in because he wants to show more emotion in his film. And this is coming from a teenager. You know, his connection to a zombie film is wanting to show more emotion, which is really kind of cool, and I think, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And he's explaining it to Joe why it's so important that he writes this wife character in and has her tell, like, the you know, his male lead that he loves her or that she loves him. And it's just, you know, these kids obviously, like, they have so much maturity in some ways, but yet they're so innocent in others. And I think that really plays out well, you know, when we get into some of the action pieces, you know, that the movie kind of sets forth.
Yeah, so the... The wife character that Charles is speaking of is actually played by Elle Fanning, who's maturing and becoming an amazing actress. She is playing the wife in the story. She is a little older than them, a little more mature, and somehow Charles has convinced her to be the female lead in the movie. Now the deal is they want to meet at this train station at, pretty late at night. But she has a car, and she's going to take them there, which is kind of strange because I don't know if they're supposed to be in middle school.
Yeah,
I think it
was middle school, yeah. The town is called Lillian, and there was when that shot comes in over top of the school when they're all getting out, it did say middle school. So, yeah, I mean, I think they're maybe transitioning maybe from middle to high school.
Middle to high school.
Something about that age, but...
Right, so there's, like, this big question mark. How did you get this girl that's a little older than us to be the lead in the movie? And she actually comes. Her name is Alice. And Alice actually picks them up in her car, which I'm pretty sure she swiped from her dad.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and led them to the train station where this first scene... is coming where she's kind of bidding her husband farewell before he goes.
Ready, be extra loud when the train passes by. Action!
I think you're in danger!
I don't have a choice!
Don't go back! Don't leave me! Guys, watch out!
Joe, what the hell are you doing?
Run!
And the actual train derailment crash action scene is ridiculously amazing.
It is ridiculous. It's long. It's loud.
It is so loud.
It's so bright. And the thing about it is, one thing about this movie is that it's not necessarily the the shock factor of things jumping out. Sometimes it's literally just the crashing that scares the living shit out of you. It happens pretty often, actually. The loud clanging of metal, the destruction, the explosions. And then also, which is one part about it that was very different than any movie I'd seen with little kids, is these kids are right in the middle of this.
Yeah, you literally see the tracking shots through the entire action, and like the kids are running through it.
Yeah, it's clanging.
And it looks so clean, you know? Yeah. It looks so, I mean, you see, and I mean, at that point, you get a very quick reminder of how insignificant these little kids are.
In comparison to this chaos.
This train accident that's happening around them, and all this fire and explosions, and it's just a really well shot scene.
It's pretty epic.
I know we both like looked at each, or I could look at you and we were both like, what? Like, holy shit.
My jaw dropped. Here's another thing about it. Not only is it a huge crash, it's a long one. It's not just 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It continues and continues because it's a long bunch of carts.
It's a big
train with maybe 10, 15 carts attached to it.
Yeah.
And it basically obliterates everything that's around it.
Yeah.
And they're left standing. Now, when they go to see where the car is, they see that it's a former teacher of theirs.
The car that derailed the train.
And they find out that it's their teacher, Dr. Woodard. He's bloodied up. He's in his truck.
The truck is literally split in half.
It's split in half. And he's hanging over the driver's, over the steering wheel. And the characters go over and kind of try to figure out if he's still alive, and he drops a piece of paper that has all these points, these red dots on this map, and they don't know what the hell it has to do with anything. And he kind of jumps up and he's like kind of mumbling, and he's warning them basically to get the hell away from everything and don't tell anybody that, you know, they saw what happened,
right?
Which is really important. So once that happens, military's coming, and they decide to leave. Now, mysteriously, the car, the Skylark that Alice brought them in, is fine. So they get in the car and kind of leave.
Well, it is a Skylark, so it's kind of indestructible. So, yeah. And it's also yellow, so it's all those trains know better than to mess with that car.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a really pretty aggressive scene, like, you know, because it's actually, you know, the teacher's like yelling at them to get out of there, to not mention it. And he actually pulls a gun on them.
He pulls a gun out. I forgot about
that. And like basically scares the shit out of them, and then they run away. Yeah, I mean, and you kind of pick up on a couple little things that they mentioned about the teacher, about like how he has this trailer at the high school or at the middle school, where like he keeps like when he confiscates stuff in class, like
puts it in there.
You know, one of the characters, I think it was Carrie, like he mentions like how he stole, or how the teacher took his like electronic football game and put it in the trailer, and he hasn't seen it since.
Yeah.
And these are little, you know, things that are alluded to that definitely come into play later in the film, but you definitely get introduced to that character, and you don't know if that's the last you see of the character, but you understand that something's going on, that all these dots on the map, you know, he's been tracking something, and this was his opportunity to do what he tried to do. And, you know, you can tell that Joe knows that, you know, this was an attempt, not just that he was, you know, in an accident. Like, he was attempting to actively disrail this train and to stop it.
And this is also the first time you get to see Elle Fanning's character, Alice, and him interact with each other.
Right.
Before the derailment. She does a scene that kind of captures their attention because she's so good at kind of conveying these emotions that they hadn't really seen in a female.
Yeah, because she's kind of like a hard shell at first. She's like, oh, I stole my dad's car. Like, get in the car. And then she does that scene where she basically is begging her, who plays her husband in Charles's movie, to not leave. And, you know, she basically, like, you can tell that all the guys basically fall in love with her right then and there.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not it's an active love or, you know, they actually care about this girl, like, they all just stop in their tracks and just, like, are just wowed by everything that she is at that moment.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, that definitely kicks off, you know, definitely the interplay between her and Joe, especially for later scenes.
Definitely. So there's also a scene, a portion of that scene when they're doing the, preparing for the scene that they're going to film. Now, they're putting on makeup, and now Joe is a makeup artist, and he's putting makeup on Alice's face. Now, there's a part where she kind of mentions his mom dying. Now, One thing that's really subtle about this thing and that J.J. Abrams does really well is kind of conveying really subtle things. So she mentions his mom. He pauses for a second and gets kind of emotional. Now, as he's doing the makeup, he tells her to close her eyes. As she closes her eyes so he can put the makeup on, his eyes start to water up. So you see that this is still really kind of an open wound for him. And also the emotion that she showed when she was acting showed that there's something behind it at first. You're right. Like, this is good, but there's something behind this emotion. Sure. Yeah. That when she's acting.
And it's probably the first real connection he's had with a female, you know, yeah. Like a girl. Like, his obviously was really close to his mom. And you know what we didn't mention in the beginning,
what?
At the opening scene, is the locket that he holds on
to. Oh yeah, the locket is.
There's a really important, just to mention it quickly, in the opening scene when we see at the funeral reception, Joe is holding on to this locket on the swing set, and you see it pop up throughout the film. And it's a keepsake. You obviously can tell that he's hanging on to something having to do with his mom. But I want to mention that now because I know that it's going to come up later when we're talking, because it's pretty symbolic and there's a lot of symbolism in the film, and that's one of the heaviest ones throughout the entire movie.
Definitely.
But once we get out of the actual train crash and the kids go home, you basically get an overall sense of, you know, they know they saw something they should not have, and in the background you kind of get this story kind of developing with, like, the military coming in. You're introduced to Nellick, who's played by Noah Emmerich. Who's one of the Air Force military, you know, I guess captains or staff sergeants, whatever the hell the rank is. But he kind of swoops in, and you can tell that there's definitely something at play that is more than just a train wreck. And we know this because it's Super 8, but, you know, in the scope of the story, Kyle Chandler's character, the father, who's, I think his name is Jackson in the film, he starts talking to Nellick, and they start having this interplay, and you can tell that Nellick's basically just telling him what he wants to hear. Like, there's nothing to be concerned about. We have this under control. It'll be a quick cleanup. And Jackson starts to notice, you know, that things are happening. Strange things are happening around the town. You know, all the dogs are running away from the area.
Which is really big. I don't know if you know about the significance of dogs leaving places. But in the tsunamis that happened over in Asia, they said that when the tsunami was about to happen, literally every animal left. Like, not even like a little bit. Every single, like chickens to, they sense danger. So that's the big thing. Like,
and it was funny when we saw my girlfriend was with us, and she like turned over and whispered to me when that happened. She's like, dogs are the first to know. I was like, wow, you're so smart.
Yeah.
Very so true. Just always follow your dogs. Yeah, if they run away, just try to ride it out of town if you can. If your dog's not big enough, like hook a barrel or like a wheelbarrow to it.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, so like all these strange things are happening. The sheriff, you know, goes missing. There's a really cool scene at a gas station. The gas station attendant goes missing. Basically, all these little things start happening. You're not really sure what's going on. You don't really see the monster or the alien, whatever, all that much. You see, like, reflections in a water puddle, which I thought is awesome.
Yes.
Little things, like quick blurs, like just very, very subtle glimpses of what this, you know, alien looks like. And that's a touch, you know. That's an obvious tip of the hat to Steven Spielberg by J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams writing and directing the film, Spielberg producing it. That's basically what made Spielberg's film Jaws what it was. You know, a film like that, a creature, you know, horror action film like that.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see the actual shark until the end of the movie, which is why, again, Jaws is one of my top 10 probably all times.
Yeah.
And this monster, you know, I don't know that it's on par with, like, the shock value and what Jaws was for its time, but, you know, not overshowing it so that you get tired of it. I feel like that's why I mentioned earlier, like, there's this human story going on, and the monster is just, like, a supporting player in it.
Yeah.
You know, you see little glimpses, but it's, like, it's not important at that time. You know, we don't need to see the monster yet. And when we need to see it, they'll show it to us, and they do, you know? So I feel like those little subtleties are really important. And the fact that throughout the film, you start seeing these things escalate into bigger and bigger ideals, you know, bigger problems. You know, you can sense that the sense of urgency with Jackson, the Kyle Chandler, the father, who's also one of the deputy sheriffs, you know, he starts to realize something really is wrong, you know, and he kind of takes it upon himself to try to troubleshoot this and figure out what's going on. you know, I think not to get too crazy heavy into the plot synopsis, because I know that we want to talk about the actual, you know, what our thoughts on the film were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the grand scheme, you know, this film is, you know, we start to see that there's a problem, that there's something going on. Little pieces start being provided that piece some of the story together. The kids actually do a little more research on what they saw. You know, when the accident happened, Charles's camera falls over and he actually takes it in to have the film develop. But at that point, you know, you don't have overnight film developing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like 3 days. And so our film basically carries out over the course of 3 days because we're basically waiting for this film to develop.
Yeah. So as it's going on, one thing that we forgot to mention is that there's this Rubik's cube like silver little square that he takes with him. There's tons and tons of them, and you don't know what it's doing. But as the story goes on, Joe put this square in his house. And as the story develops, as it starts to boil and boil and boil, this cube changes forms. It goes from a square to kind of something that's protruding out of the square and starts shaking. And it's doing all these weird things that he's not really noticing at first. The chaos is picking up. The government is starting to do bigger things in order to cover everything that's going on. They're transferring all these information over the airwaves, and it's
like on ham radio,
yeah, on
like
ham radios.
CB radios,
yeah. So they decode it, they descramble it, they get a descrambler, and they figure out that there's this big project that they're talking about that the sheriff, Joe's father, finds out about. Now, this cover up is basically to get everybody out of the town so that they can find this monster and kill it, destroy it, or capture it.
Yeah,
you're not quite sure, but what they do in order to start this chaos is to basically burn the fields in the area, start this fire, and basically evacuate everyone and investigate the monster.
Right.
And that's kind of when it starts to pick up, and it turns from you know, something that's a little chaotic into something that's erratic almost. And that's when the action starts to super pick up. At this point, appliances are being taken. Engines are being taken out of cars, and you don't really know what's going on. So it's
like all this metal.
All this metal
is just, you know, being just disappearing. And you see, like, you know, he said, TV sets, microwaves, washer, dryers. The police department are getting all these calls about stolen material, like appliances like that. And it's just like, you know, they just all have this perplexed look. Like, what the hell? Like, why would somebody do that? Like, engines, like he said, and a complete engine coming out of a car. You know, you would need like a lift to do that, or some sort of crane to do that, and it's happening overnight with no trace of evidence. So these little things that are happening, you know, kind of building up to the big thing that Ronald just mentioned, which is when the Air Force initiates they call it Operation Walking Distance. You know, that's when they try to get everyone out of the town so that they could basically quarantine the town and, I guess, take this monster back. But, and that, you know, that it's funny as we're talking about it, that's what I think is one of the strengths of the film, is that we are only given enough information as if we are, like, basically watching this movie as a kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, that's one of the things I really like about it, is that we only get enough, we only get what we need to have in this film. We're not, they're not spelled out in complete sentences, they're phrases. You know, they're, you know, little things dropped here and there. I know I mentioned it earlier, but I think it's really important because, you know, we basically are having this film, we're discovering this film as if we were one of the kids that are the male, you know, the child leads in the film.
Yeah, the discovery aspect is the best part about it. We're not granted what's called that God point of view, where you can see literally what everything that's going on. You're literally getting the pieces as the people are getting the pieces. And because of that, it makes the development of the story that much better. It's almost as if you're a townsperson.
Yeah.
You're the sheriff in his scene.
Yeah.
You're the characters. You're the friends.
Right.
And one thing that has to be mentioned is how amazing the friendships are between all the people involved in making the film. Charles and Joe and Alice and
Carrie, yeah.
The fireworks guy. As you see them interact with each other, you get this idea that these guys are really very close. And that friendship is what helps them get through the chaos that's about to ensue. And it's important that you know that, because it, you know what, one thing about it that makes it so heartfelt is that the relationships between people are very, very apparent, very strong. You feel them. You get the jokes when they're joking around about, you know, they call each other pussy and call each other fat and dumb and ridiculous. And you're laughing with these characters as they're laughing at, you know.
You almost feel like you're like, you know, the invisible friend in this situation.
Yeah. Steve actually had an equation for what he thought this movie was. So if you could share the equation.
Yeah, this is what I was referencing earlier when I posted the Super 8 poster on the blog.
Yeah.
And this is just from the trailers I'd seen, what I've read. I wrote this equation: Stand By Me plus E.T. plus The Goonies plus Fringe, maybe times a little War of the Worlds, I don't know, equals Super 8. And that's just like, I feel like that's a pretty accurate equation.
Yeah, I think so.
I feel the first three, Stand By Me, E.T., and The Goonies, is that coming of age kind of story. You know, it's the story of friends, it's the story of kids.
Yeah.
You know, that are challenged in a situation that not only tests their relationships with one another, it also tests their relationships with adults around them.
Yeah.
And it tests their relationship with some outside factor. You know, in Stand By Me, it was the body that they were looking for.
Yeah.
You know, in E.T., it's obviously the extraterrestrial. In The Goonies, it's obviously, you know, the treasure that they're looking for.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Fringe and War of the Worlds, that's the obvious sci-fi action element of it. And, you know, Fringe, obviously, J.J. Abrams having something to do with, you know, there's a touch of that in this film. But I think that is really what, you know, those are the kind of movies I love. Like, the coming-of-age stories, I think that the movies that make me remember when I was a kid and, like, you know, I was in situations like that where either my friendship was really tested with someone or my relationship was really tested with an adult. You know, you just harken back to those moments. And, I mean, I think a movie like this, it's kind of a rarity these days. Like, so many movies are one-sided, and I'm not trying to say that this film, like, redefines the cinema as it is, but it's definitely one of the movies that I've, one of the top films that I've seen recently, only because it touches a chord with me. You know, it touches me deeply, personally, because I remember movies like this when I was a kid that made me want to watch a movie again.
Yeah, exactly. You know? There's something about the effort that J.J. Abrams puts into his stories, the heart that he puts into it, that's not necessarily present in current movies that you see. That goes back to, like you said, the 80s movies where you would watch it 10, 15 times.
Yeah.
This movie has soul. I mean, there's no other way to put it. It has a soul to it that I haven't seen in a movie in a long time.
And just like any, you know, any person, any soul, any you know, basically being, it really kind of touches on transitions.
Yeah.
For the better, for the worse, just period. You know, for kids transitioning from kids to, you know, a child to an adult, or from a child that has a mother to your mother being gone, or, you know, not having a relationship with your dad and being forced to. And in Alice's character, or her situation, her character, you know, having to transition from basically not having any confidence or faith or any interest in your father to actually, you know, talking to your father.
Yeah.
You know, in Charles's case, transitioning from, you know, we find out that, you know, he actually likes Alice too, and that he's kind of upset with Joe about it, but he's more so upset that Alice actually likes Joe back.
How am I supposed to be a zombie?
Oh, pretty much just be a lifeless ghoul with no soul, dead eyes, scary. Did you ever have Miss Mullen?
For English?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of like her, but hungry for human flesh. Like, she wants to turn somebody into a zombie. Because that's kind of what zombies do.
Okay. It's all about these transitions, and I mean, I feel like going from a child to an adult, and you realize that life isn't like the movies that they're making.
Yeah,
you know, some things are completely uncontrollable, and that even though, you know, in the movie that they make, they can yell, cut, and do it again to fix it, in real life, there's things that you can't stop. Things that you cannot control, things that your parents even cannot protect you from.
Yeah.
And that element, I feel like, is what makes this movie all about transitioning. And there's a couple scenes that really stand out in my mind, just to mention real quick. A scene with Joe and Alice when she goes to his room at night and she is like, you know, he's showing her these model trains that he makes. And there's a really nice, like, very emotional scene where he accidentally starts up a projector that Joe has obviously been watching, and it's footage of his mother. Oh, yeah,
because the electricity at that point was off.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
Because, oh, that's another thing. So because of these attacks, the alien attacks, the electricity is kind of going on and off.
Right.
It turns back on, and while the electricity was on, he was watching footage of his mother. So as he's watching it, you know, it's you know, his mom and him as a kid, you see the necklace that he used to have, that she used to wear. And then Alice starts to kind of break down crying, and she tells him,
This is a pretty big discovery.
Yeah, it's a pretty big discovery. She tells him basically the circumstances of the day that his mom died, basically that her father, was out of it. He was drunk. He didn't want to work that day. Joe's mom and her dad worked at the same place. He didn't want to work that shift, so he asked her to work. Now, when he asked her to work, an accident happened at the job, and he felt terrible about it. And you kind of get that sense as you see him kind of functioning in the movie that he's very sorry about it. But it's the first time that you actually hear somebody verbalize that was the circumstance. He didn't mean it. There was no ill will. Like, it was very much an accident. He didn't know that was going to happen.
Sure.
Had he have known, he would have done it himself. He would have died in place of her.
Yeah, and it's a really good scene between Alice and Joe, just because like they connect on an emotional level, and it is a moment of maturity for both of them, because Joe is able to address the fact that he finds this out and is able to say, you know what, I'm going to put aside my anger or my emotions and make Alice feel better about this, because she's crying, like, you know, and he assures her, you know, it's okay, it was an accident, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's a really nice scene, you know, basically showing how innocent these kids are, but how mature they're being and being forced to be under circumstances.
Definitely.
And the other scene is basically, it's a similar scene between Joe and Charles when they kind of basically come to this moment where they just, everything bursts, and you could tell there's some tension growing, and they just kind of confront one another. And that's where you find out that, you know, Joe and Charles have been at odds, because, you know, Charles knows that Joe really likes Alice, and... Mm-hmm. And we find out that Charles likes her too, and that's the reason that he asked her to be in his film. And that, you know, the big problem with it is that Charles realizes that Alice likes Joe back, you know, and it's a problem. And not only because, you know, she likes Joe and not Charles, but I'm sure that Charles, and you can tell, as best friends, I mean, I've been in that situation before where you're like, oh man, you have a girlfriend now, or you have a girl that likes you now, now we're not going to be best friends. And it's those moments that kind of feel a little threatening a little bit, but... It's a really good scene, and for two kid actors, like, who have done very little to no acting before, like you said, the kid that plays Joe is his first film.
Yeah, so it's Charles's too.
Okay. It's an awesome scene, and they both just kill it, and it's like, it really made me kind of like upset a little bit, you know? I was like, I felt for them. Because I've been in that moment before where you like feel threatened that you're losing your friend.
Definitely.
But it's a really, really great scene. Both of those scenes, only kids in the scene, no adults. And they just completely destroy the scene. It's awesome.
Amazing. Now, one thing also that happens is kind of the role reversals that happen. So you have Charles that kind of leads the pack at the beginning of the movie. He's the director. He's very aggressive. And then when things happen, when things get chaotic, Joe kind of steps up.
Yeah.
There's something about it, his character. Like, he has all this angst and this pain, and it brings about this strength. When the craziness happens.
Right.
And you start to see that the leader isn't Charles necessarily. It is on the movie front, but on the life front, Joe is where it's at. And I think it's kind of related to his dad being kind of a pillar of strength in the community. He is the deputy. The sheriff's gone because he's been snatched by the alien.
Right.
And the deputy's kind of stepping up. So he's seeing his dad becoming this person that he hadn't seen him become before.
Right.
And then also he's becoming this person that he hadn't been before.
Yeah, the great comparison is that, you know, Charles is the leader when he can control everything.
Yeah.
You know, he's the director. Yeah. He says, stop, go, you know, I can fix this, let's do it again. But in life, when you can't control those things and the bad things happen that you can't fix, that's the real challenge. And I think that's where Joe steps up, and you do see him become the leader. You know, and when the town's being evacuated and the kids are running all over the place, the kids decide to basically break out of the quarantine and go back to that trailer that I mentioned earlier at the school. And that's where they discover some footage. That the Dr. Woodward had, or is it Woodward or Woodard, had, yeah, had collected. Woodward. And you find out the backstory of the doctor, and you know that he used to work for the military. He was dishonorably discharged about, you know, 9 or 10 years prior. And you find out about this alien backstory and what is actually going on. And not really to kind of ruin everything, so we don't need to hit on everything, but you understand more at that point. There's closure, there's that discovery with the kids that they are actively pursuing, and we kind of just, you know, learn about it with them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So it's important that you see kind of what they discover in the trailer, and that relates to the bigger story of what is this thing? What is it doing? What is its motivations? And you hear the character, Dr. Woodward, when he's been kind of taken away by the military. He's bloodied up. He's been beaten up from the car crash, and you see the military speaking to him, and he says, you know, when the alien touches me, I get him, and he gets me.
Yeah, there's like a psychological connection.
There's a psychological connection.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of sets the pace for the rest of the film, is like when you start to realize that, you know, that maybe this isn't the worst alien in the world or in the galaxy or in the universe. You start to realize maybe why this alien invasion isn't the spine of this movie. You know, it's more the kids, you know, these kids and how they deal with everything. But I don't know, I guess there's... Just overall, I think the movie just does a really great job of just intentionally only letting us know what we need to know at any given point in time. I think that there's a lot of symbolism in the movie, and I don't know if we want to touch on that. I mentioned the locket. It's a really big thing. That's like Joe's last piece that he has of his mom and his dad got for him before they, you know, before they bury his mom. You know, and inside of it's a picture of them. And he explains to Alice at one point, you know, what the importance of the locket is, because she's noticed it a few times. And, you know, as we find out more about what this alien is attempting to do, you know, it's just like you see where that locket may come into play, you know, like where it becomes a symbol. Because one of the biggest, actually, probably the best scene, I think I mentioned it earlier, when Alice and Joe were in his room, she asks him about the locket.
Yeah.
And he explains why it's so important to him. And there's a moment where he tells her that there was a way that his mom used to look at him that he just knew that he was there. Like, he knew he existed.
Definitely.
She looked at him in a way that just let him know, you know you're there. I'm here for you, and I know you're there. And he hasn't felt that way since she has passed. And there's a scene at the end of the film where the kids, you know, they basically have tracked down the alien. They know what's going on. They have a better picture of what its intentions are and its motivations. And having found out what Dr. Woodward said about, you know, connecting with the alien, and if it knows that you are good-willed and not trying to hurt it, you know, that there maybe not isn't much of a threat.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where, like, they basically are cornered, and they, you know, there's no other options, and the alien has them in this cavern, and Joe basically steps up and makes an effort. You know, he says, you know, we're not going to hurt you. Yeah. You know, it's going to be okay. I'm no threat to you. And the alien picks him up, and, you know, you physically see the alien basically take these blinders kind of thing off of its eyes.
Yeah.
And you see it actually look at Joe, and you see Joe look at it. And that is that scene where I feel like he realized that there are other things, whether it's human or not, that know he's there. Yeah. And it's a really big scene, because that is a scene that I think transitions him from a young man into, you know, or from a kid into a young man, you know, because the scenes that follow that pertaining to the locket, you know, when he's at a point where he feels comfortable enough to let that locket go.
Yeah.
I think it's all because of that one scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. Now, another thing that's really, really cool, that's really pretty deep, is that Alice and Joe are essentially the same person in a lot of ways. And so are their fathers. So Alice's father lost his wife. Joe's father lost his wife. They both are kind of in this period where they're parenting, they're kind of doubting themselves as parents. They're not too close to their kids. And also the kids are dealing with the loss of their mothers. So when they meet each other, it's not very apparent how connected they are in that way. But you start to realize through the interactions that the fathers have with each other, how connected they are in that way. You see this scene where Alice comes in later than she should after doing the shoot. And the father's like, you know, you're just like your mother. You act like your mother. And you know that he's lost his mother, his wife at that point. And she's really kind of in pain because of that. And when she leaves out, kind of angrily, he gets into a car accident. He gets into a car accident, kind of chasing her down because he's drunk. And that's when the alien captures her. And, you know, you fast forward to when he says that the kind words to the alien, and the alien kind of drops Joe down. It's kind of the beginning of, like you said, that adulthood. But also the beginning of the alien kind of realizing that maybe everybody isn't here to kill me. So I don't have to attack everybody. So there's one thing that happens during the course of the movie that's very apparent. This isn't E.T. This alien will kill people.
Yeah, there's literally there's blood, there's language, there's guns, there is some carnage. You know? He definitely fucks some people up.
He fucks people up. But that's the cool part about it. The alien kind of, you realize that the alien can tell the difference between somebody that wants to hurt him and somebody that's trying to aid him. Because if you see during the course of the movie, he snatches people up and you're pretty sure that they're dead. But at the end of the movie, you see that they're not. They're actually in these sort of pod-like states, hung upside down, unconscious.
Right.
So he doesn't kill everyone. He kills people that literally stand in the way of what he's trying to do. Military people get demolished in this fucking movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they've been holding him back from getting to his native planet for apparently 10, 20 years, like a decade.
Yeah, over a decade, yeah.
So one thing we didn't touch on so much is the acting aspect of this. Because we talked about the story. We've been kind of beating it over the head with the plot of the movie.
Sure. Yeah, let's get away from the plot.
Let's get away from the plot and talk about the acting of this movie. So Alice's father, tremendous in this movie. He's very, you could tell that there's two things weighing on him. The loss of his wife and also partially feeling responsible, well, completely feeling responsible for the death of Joe's mother. Two things weighing on him, and it's starting to manifest itself in alcoholism. So he's like abusing alcohol. Yeah. He's being not so nice to his daughter, Alice. Right. And because of that, because of that, and also Joe's dad feeling that he's partially responsible, he hates Alice's father. He also doesn't want Joe to hang out with his daughter, because that equals kind of like it's an extension. She's an extension of that dude.
And so it's a reminder.
It's a reminder of the death of his wife. So this conflict is going on the entire movie between Alice's father and Joe's father. They're kind of going head to head, and that is conveyed so well. One thing also, the sheriff, he is a beast in this movie.
Kyle Chandler?
Yeah,
the Kyle dad. Chandler.
He has a hero face. And I know that's why J.J. Abrams hired him. He has that kind of like fatherly sort of a face, but he also has a hero's face. He looks like you knew from the moment you saw him, he's going to do something significant in this movie.
Yeah, I love Kyle Chandler. I'm a huge fan of his. He's on, if anybody's not watched Friday Night Lights on TV, the TV series about the football team, one of my probably all-time favorite TV shows. Just end it. It's run. Get the DVDs. He plays the coach on the series. Love the guy. He's incredible. He's subtle in this film. He's perfect for what he needs to be. He's the widower. He's the dad that's trying but doesn't know really how.
Yeah.
And he basically is there to kind of serve as like, you know, as a foundation for Joe's emotional discovery throughout the whole movie.
Definitely. There's a scene that they have the first time you actually see them interact for longer than 5 seconds, honestly.
Yeah.
Where the father's basically like, you cannot hang out with Alice. It's ridiculous. And he's like, I don't know why I would not. It doesn't make any sense. Why would I not hang out with her? Right. She's nice. She's kind. And he basically says that this is the first time I've ever had to do something where so many people are asking so much of me. I need this. I need to take this time to help these people. Now, during the course of this whole yelling spat, Joe starts to tear up. But you see, Kyle Chandler's character, Jackson Lamb, he's conflicted. He wants to hug him. He wants to show that emotion. He wants to be like, you know, a pillar, a strength for him. But also at the same time, he doesn't know how to do that exactly. Because he's new to being a full-time, just the only parent in this kid's life. And it's a really powerful scene because you see him looking into his son's eyes. He's tearing up. He's crying. He's vulnerable. You could tell that Jackson wants to hug him, but he has to help the rest of the town. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And those sort of awkward interactions are kind of what happened throughout the movie. You see that this guy, he wants to be a good father. He doesn't know how to be a good father.
Right.
And that's actually solved at the end of the movie. Like, that's the cool part about J.J. Abrams' style. So there's these conflicts that happen at the beginning. Like, Alice didn't like Joe when he first met him. When she first met him, because Joe was attached to the
sheriff,
yeah. You know, it's police. She has a stolen car. And then she starts to get to know him. The father isn't necessarily a good father at first. He's very, like, you know, he's new to it, very uncomfortable with the idea of being in the father role. Same thing with Alice's father, very uncomfortable with the father role. Yeah. And it starts to develop. And that's one of the things that makes this movie so amazing. It's not about the alien. It's about the relationships between people.
Yep.
One thing I forgot to touch on also is Joel McKinnon Miller. He plays the father of Charles. He's also in Big Love. Yeah. He's a polygamist in Big Love. This guy also wants to support Joe. He sees that this is going on. Charles's whole family loves the idea of Joe kind of being around. So they also constantly invite him. There's little pockets in the movie where they're like, you know, Joe, come over for a meal. Joe, do this. Because they see how much pain is going on between these two people, between Joe's father and Joe. And that's a big part of the movie. So, yeah, it's powerful, man. It's powerful stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to take away from our criticism of the film is just, like, how much we've been talking about story.
Yeah.
And how much we've been talking about people and characters. And when you talk about a movie like Super 8 that is, like, built off of, you know, the marketing for the film has been actually quite good, in my opinion, you know, having come from a marketing background, I think, you know, intentionally not showing a lot of the, you know, the creature is good because it kind of doesn't put all the focus on it. But showing some almost lets you be a little bit blindsided when you go to the film and you're like, wow, this is, like, a really good story, too.
Yeah.
It's not just, like, a big action film like a lot of us are kind of set up to expect these days. A lot of shitty movies coming out. You know, in the past, whatever, 5-10 years, you know, movies that are all about action and no substance, you know, it's all visual and no meaning. So, you know, when you go into a film, if you don't have a lot of expectations for this film in terms of what it is, I think that's really good because, you know, you can go in and look for the monster and you'll see the monster and you'll be entertained by that. But I think what's really going to wow you is, you know, these interplays between these kids and, you know, and the adults that are in their lives and in the minimal roles that you see them in the film. But, you know, what role the adults do play, it really sets up, you know, that kind of coming of age moment for the kids.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm trying to think. So we've been praising this movie like crazy.
I'm going to put it out there right now. I fucking love the movie.
I fucking loved it, too.
I know when we left the theater last night, we were both like, let's not talk about this because we need to have something to talk about today. And obviously, we could talk about it for a while. But, I mean, I straight up, you know.
I was trying to think of something that I didn't like about it, and I could not really think of anything.
I mean, there are little things I feel like that pop up throughout the movie that are kind of not so much a bad thing, but I mean, I think that there are a couple things that are maybe, you know, that could have been a little different. I think that some moviegoers may have concern with, and I mean, not me personally, but may have concern with how violent some of it gets.
Oh yeah,
you know, for being PG-13, you know, some of the, you know, action slash like attack scenes, or the moments of true like suspense and slash terror. I mean, like, I've already seen some stuff online with some people, like, some parent groups and, like, some people calling, you know, the PG-13 rating, like, ridiculous. It should have been loose. An R.
It should have been R. I mean,
you know, and some of the language, too, you know.
I loved it.
It kind of walked. Me, too. I loved it. I feel like some people, though, are going to have issue with.
Yeah.
With some of the language, you know. And I feel like it's weird to say this, but I think some of the least fleshed out storyline part, you know,
yeah.
is the alien side of the alien side of it.
Yeah, there was really no it's really a cursory glance at the alien. That's it. Yeah. Like, there's not much story to it. That really,
you know,
is.
you basically find out the backstory of it when the kids find that reel in the doctor's trailer. You know, the teacher's trailer, like, you find out that this alien crashed, and it was, like, at Area 51 in the 60s, and that they found out that, you know, or he found out that this alien wasn't a real threat. It was basically just trying to rebuild its spaceship, which are made up of all those little Rubik's Cubes things that we mentioned that the kid took away from the scene, and, you know, that it's been trying to get its way, make its way home. Like, it just wants to go home, you know, like... Hello, E.T., you know, let the alien go home. Like, it's not a danger unless we pose danger to it, which obviously the military being positioned the way it is in most films, it is. Like, the military is trying to harm it. It's trying to, you know, probe it and learn from it and, like, you know, what is its defenses and what weapons does it have or, you know. And they basically have this thing caged up for 10 years and they're transporting it across country and the doctor sees it as an opportunity to try to break it free. Like Ronald said... The doctor mentioned, like, when the creature touches you, it has, like, a psychic connection to you. It senses your being. You know, if you are a good person that's not going to harm it, it's going to not harm you.
Yeah.
And, you know, the doctor was trying to make good on a connection that he had to this creature 10 years prior and try to break it free. And while the creature does get loose, you know, it's still at challenge now at this point because that Nellet character is back in town and, you know, trying to kill it or capture it or whatever. But I think that's important, though. I mean, because, like, while the story with the alien is not super fleshed out, I feel like that it doesn't need to be, you know, in my opinion. You know, it's the background music. It's the muzak for this movie. Like,
should have got a little more face time, though. I feel like...
You think so?
Yeah, just a little bit more. Okay. I don't even think a lot. The first time you ever see this thing face-to-face is when it picks up Joe and kind of stares in his face.
Yeah.
And then puts him down. That's it. Funny enough, if the glances that you get at it are very small, at first you think it's just a spider.
It looks like kind of, you know, like spider.
Arachnid sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you see the face at the gas station. So you have a face to it, sort of. And that's cool. But it had a very small amount of time on the screen, which I think is necessary. All right, so modern technology is amazing, but we still haven't gotten down things moving naturally in terms of CGI. Now, I like the fact that it didn't show it to the point where you're, like, annoyed by the way it moves or annoyed by the way it functions because it looks ugly. I mean, like, I haven't seen a movie yet that really has a movement down right when it comes to CGI. And that's why they choose to have it in those awkward sort of movements, like a spider-like or something like that. So now that I think about it, maybe it's not that bad that they didn't show it a lot. You would get sick of it because it would probably look like shit versus the background.
Yeah.
And if you go back, I have a feeling that this is going to be one of those movies. You'll see it 10 years later and you're like, man, this is amazing. It still looks amazing. Still looks polished. And kind of taking those glimpses... It was a good step, and the interaction when they had where he kind of picked him up and looked in his face.
Yeah,
maybe that was all you needed.
Yeah,
maybe that's all you needed.
Yeah, yeah. I just think overall it's definitely a movie, you know, that is worth checking out. I mean, it's a summer blockbuster, but it's kind of like the anti-summer blockbuster because it's not that bang bang shoot 'em up popcorn flick.
Yeah,
it's a popcorn flick because, you know, you can completely get lost in this movie. The pacing is incredible. I did not feel like it was 2 hours.
Me either.
I was, like, ready for more. Acting's great. Story, I feel like, you know, I obviously connect to it. It makes me kind of all warm and fuzzy inside thinking about movies that I watched as a kid. And even wanting to make movies myself when I was a kid. And even to this day, having, you know, a latent kind of urge to be able to make movies like they were making in the film and just have that sense of urgency.
Definitely.
Definitely connect to it on many levels. The music is awesome. It's super, you know, relevant for the scenes and kind of a couple scenes in the movie kind of gave me cold chills here and there. I got nothing but positive things. I mean, there's little things that could be tweaked that would make it perfect, but You know, the fact that it's not perfect is fine by me. It's as close to perfect as I feel I've gotten this summer with a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. I'm really excited to see it again. I'm hoping that audiences go out and see it this Onan's opening weekend. Hoping that it catches on word of mouth, because I hope a film like this deserves to be successful. It's important for movies like this to be successful, because this is what movies, can be when they're a little more ambitious. It's not like some crazy Inception idea, you know, or, you know, yeah. A movie that's breaking the mold. It's more of a movie that's throwing us back to knowing this is how simple a movie can be and still be extremely powerful. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very good movie. And then on top of it being so amazing, they give you a treat at the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So check that out when you get
a chance.
Don't
leave when the credits start rolling, because it doesn't start for like a moment after.
Yeah,
you know?
It's so worth it. It's ridiculous.
Basically, you know, the movie that the kids are making throughout Super 8, their little zombie film, you know, you basically get to see the final product of that during the credits for Super 8. So don't leave. You see all the kids acting, all their chops, and, you know.
Yeah.
It's super fun. Crowd loved it that we were with. We loved the little film at the end.
It's really good.
And you said one of the kids that are in the movie, they actually wrote it, right?
Gabriel Basso, the kid that played the detective, the male lead, wrote the entire thing, aside from like one scene that J.J. Abrams wrote.
For the student film. He wrote that.
Yeah.
Wow,
he wrote
that's cute.
The whole thing, which is pretty incredible. It's funny. It reminds me of movies that I wanted to make when I was a kid.
Exactly.
And now, even now.
Exactly.
Like, just had a good sense of humor to it. And jump cuts. I love jump cuts in movies. You know, it's really awkward and sloppy sometimes. And it's really pretty cool.
So, I mean, to sum it up, I know that we could probably keep talking about this movie. And it's just like, you know, this is a movie that we both really liked. You know, it's definitely worth checking out. So please go support a film like this. You know, go see it again if you've already seen it by the time you've heard this podcast. Or recommend a friend or family member to see it.
J.J. Abrams is a future.
Yeah, he is a filmmaker on the verge of just, you know, I feel like if he can find the right projects and get them made, you know, for kids that are in their teens now that like film, you know, he is going to be, hopefully, like what Spielberg and, you know, Zemeckis and, you know, was in the 80s for films like this, for ambitious, you know, films. And hopefully, you know, commercially they're successful too, because that's what made those filmmakers so, you know, so relevant, and everybody knows them because movies blew up, and movies like E.T. were huge, and movies like Back to the Future for Zemeckis was huge, and hopefully a movie like this for J.J. Abrams will kind of give him that pedestal to stand on and say, hey, like, I am actually an original filmmaker that does not need a franchise to be successful at the box office. So
definitely.
Go check it out. You know, it opens on June 10th. So now we're going to talk a little bit about some DVD quick picks.
DVD
quick We're going to wrap picks. It up here, but we have a couple DVD quick picks if you want to go ahead and throw yours out there.
Right. So the one I've chosen is an amazing foreign film. It is called The Host. Now, The Host came out in 2006. It is a South Korean movie about a monster that kind of comes and starts attacking people. It looks so clean. It's filmed so well. The acting is very good. And it's definitely worth checking out. Now, the reason I loved it so much is that, I don't know, like, I like monster movies. And it's one of those monster movies that had heart. There's two characters that it kind of revolves around, a store owner and his kid, and then a couple other people, a couple of their acquaintances. But it has heart, which I love, you know. One person gets kidnapped, and then one of the characters steps up, the main character steps up and kind of tries to save the world. Because this thing is going to pretty much rip everything apart. And he does rip most people apart. Most buildings, and The Host is a good movie. So I think they have it at Best Buy. It's like $10 now. 2006. It has some comedic elements as well. So check The Host out. The Host. South Korean movie, The Host. And it might be, you know, I think it actually is on Netflix.
Yeah, I've actually seen the film, too. It's definitely a lot of fun. A great creature feature.
Yeah.
One that actually has, like, you know, we've been talking about today, actually has quite a bit of character in it, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
With the main character. But definitely worth checking out. For mine, I actually am gonna, you know, stay on my 80s throwback wagon. And I'm gonna throw out the Goonies. The Goonies were good enough for me in 85, and the Goonies are still good enough for me.
I feel like you throw a wild card out. That's like one of the greatest movies ever. If you want to learn how to make a movie in that sort of format, adventure, a bunch of kids, charismatic kids on top of that, a very young Josh Brolin.
Dude, you got Josh Brolin, yeah. Corey Feldman, yeah. Sean Astin.
Yeah.
Who would go on to be Samwise Gamgee in the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Crazy.
You know, just an awesome cast. And well, the reason I pick it is obviously we mentioned it earlier, just like the idea of these kids being the story with these outside things going on, the adults that don't understand them, the adults that they're trying to get to understand them, and this challenge that they have, this journey that they take together to not only discover, you know, what it is to be, a, you know, young adult, but also to reach that achievement. But the Goonies, the, you know, the music, the comedy, the heroes, it's just, you know, I've seen that movie, God, too many times actually, yeah, to talk about. But the reason I chose it as my quick pick, obviously Spielberg all over it. I think he was an executive producer of it. But also this past November they came out with a 25th anniversary DVD. DVD is worth checking out if you like the Goonies or haven't seen it or just want to see it again. But the DVD has a lot of really cool special features on it. Commentary with the actors, which I love commentary tracks. I am a stickler for them.
I just got into it. I
love watching it. Like, I will watch a movie for the 100th time just because it's an audio commentary track. Yeah. I love it when it's with the filmmaker and some of the actors, because you find out a lot of these little tidbits about the making of the film, which I love to hear.
Yeah.
You also have a documentary, you know, that comes on the DVD. The some outtakes, Cyndi Lauper video for Goonies Are Good Enough, which was her song from the film. But just a really fun movie, you know. I feel like there hasn't been a movie like The Goonies for, you know, that age group since The Goonies, you know.
Yeah.
There have been a couple that have tried to be, you know, like it, but Goonies, it's on DVD. Unfortunately, neither of the movies that we picked this week are on Netflix yet again.
Yeah.
Netflix, man, come on, get with it.
Get
all
the goodies.
All these classics, man. The $7.99 is awesome, but if you ain't got the classics,
yes,
you ain't got my $7.99.
Goonies is top.
Yeah,
top,
you gotta check out the Goonies. Spielberg, I love you. Can I clean your pool? I don't know. Let me do something in your life. I just want to hang out. But yeah, guys, I mean, the host, Goonies, they're both on DVD. Neither on Netflix, but go grab them. You download it. We'll do whatever you need to do. The Goonies DVD is 25th anniversary special edition. Absolutely a must have if you've seen it before. It's amazing. It's one of my faves. But I think that pretty much wraps up what we're doing. Basically, again, we have our new URL, movieshmovie.net. So hit us up there. That links right to our Tumblr account. We also have our Twitter page, which we are slowly but surely gathering a lot of followers.
Oh, yeah. We got
a good
following.
So we're growing. We're growing. Yeah. We also have our movieshmovie@gmail.com email address. So, you know, keep sending us feedback. You know, if you want to have one of your movie suggestions reviewed for our Mighty Minute review at the next podcast, shoot us a message at movieshmovie@gmail.com or post it on our Twitter account. And
also, the podcast is on iTunes.
Yep, iTunes.
Also, Mixcloud. Just put it up on Mixcloud. So it's multiple ways to listen to the podcast. Mixcloud, you can get the Mixcloud app for your iPhone. Just search Movie Schmovie. You can search it. The difference between the one on iTunes and the one on Mixcloud is a little different. Has chapters, which is pretty cool.
Oh, nice.
So if you
I haven't gotten into the Mixcloud, so I have to check it out.
Yeah, you need to check it out, man. So I'm going to post the podcast in the Mixcloud format on the blog so you can see how it's formatted. Subscribe to it on iTunes. Make sure you tell people about this podcast. It is steadily picking up steam. I really appreciate the support that you guys have been showing.
Yeah, I mean, the feedback we've been getting from the people listening has been very positive. They definitely made some suggestions and ways for us to improve it, which we definitely intend to do.
Yeah.
And like I said, when we started, we're trying to figure out ways to kind of, like, make this a lean and mean podcast. We're going to try to cut the fat, you know, try to make sure that we stick to our segments. And, you know, make it something that we would listen to ourselves. So that's our goal. So keep that in mind. We're not trying to make anything that we wouldn't listen to ourselves. So, you know, your feedback is really important. So just, you know, don't hesitate in sending anything in, even if you're telling us that we are doing something horrible. We will surely address it and fix it.
Cool.
So post some reviews. Tell your friends, please, because Movie Schmovie, it's really important to us. And hopefully we'll be able to stick around for a while. Like I said, we're on episode 003, so we're being pretty optimistic about this. So hopefully with your support, we can get up to those triple digits. So again, thank you so much for listening. This is Steve.
This is Ron.
And you've made our day. Take care, guys. See ya.